From the Missouri School of Journalism, this is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. After World War II, U.S. forces led by General Douglas MacArthur occupied Japan. Less than 2 years later, Japan enacted a new constitution. Now, this constitution included a provision that MacArthur had pushed for known as Article 9, or the Pacifist Clause, that says Japan would, quote, forever renounce war. Now, in the decades since, of course, Japan has transformed itself from a defeated and impoverished country into an economic powerhouse. And though it's avoided military confrontation with other countries, it has built up what it refers to as its, quote, self-defense forces, which in many ways resemble an army, navy, and air force. But now with North Korea increasingly belligerent and the Trump administration sending mixed messages about how it would defend U.S. allies, Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe wants to change that pacifist clause. Abe's effort was bolstered after recent parliamentary elections gave his ruling Liberal Democratic Party and its coalition partner more than two-thirds of the seats in Japan's parliament. On this edition of Global Journalist, a look at Japan's pacifist history and what a change might mean for East Asia and the U.S. Now, in a few minutes, we'll talk to a panel of guests who have been following the politics of this closely. But first, we're joined by Andrew Gordon. He's a professor of history who researches Japan at Harvard University. Andrew, welcome to Global Journalist.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Tell us why and how this clause was put in Japan's constitution in the first place.
Well, as you know, and as the audience knows, Japan suffered a horrendous defeat in World War II. About 3 million people, Japanese people, both military and civilian, were killed, both in the Japanese Empire and battlefront and at home. And so at the popular level, there was a tremendous revulsion for war and also a huge distrust and anger at the military who launched the war. So that sort of made the ground fertile for what was then produced, I would say, as a co-production of General MacArthur and the American occupation, but also some of the Japanese leadership. The precise dynamics that led to this peace clause being put into the Constitution are still debated. But there's no question that there were two key figures, Douglas MacArthur, the Supreme Commander of the American Allied Powers running the occupation, and also a Japanese Prime Minister at the time, Shidehara. And those two came to agree and support this.
But is this seen as a bad thing in Japan that an American general was so influential in drafting this part of their constitution?
Well, the fact that the Americans wrote the constitution in about 6 days in the winter of 1946 was not made publicly known. And there was a lot of suspicion because of the content and the actual language of it. Even in Japanese, it read like a translation that the American hand was heavy. But it was the Americans told the Japanese leaders, present this to your diet, to your parliament as your draft and ratify it. And that's what happened.
Well, the article at issue of the Constitution, it says, quote, Japan will forever renounce war and that, quote, land, sea and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized. So, like, how has this been interpreted in practice?
Well, it's been interpreted over time to mean, and the Japanese Supreme Court has ratified this, that it's okay to have a self-defense force, even with that very clear language that you just read out. The first clause that says Japan renounces war forever, I think is one that even the people who want to change the Constitution don't want to get rid of. The second clause that says, to that end, we will not maintain a military, is the more controversial one. And the Japanese Supreme Court has said what is really meant there is a military for the purposes of starting wars, not for self-defense. So that's the logic by which Japan's got today, depending on how you measure it, the sixth or seventh largest military in the world.
Well, tell us about sort of the U.S. perspective on this clause. It makes sense that after World War II, the U.S. wouldn't want Japan to have a military, but that situation obviously in East Asia changed over the past few decades.
That's right, and it didn't take more than a few years until the Korean War starts for the Americans to begin to have second thoughts and regrets and actually begin to either encourage or be quietly accepting of an effort that Japan might undertake to revise the constitution. And I think the Americans actually by the mid-50s figured it would probably be revised. But the bar to revision is high in terms of the legal steps that have to be maintained. And the Japanese Liberal Democratic Party, although it didn't like this clause, it's in its founding manifesto in 1955, and ever since it's had revision of this as a key plank in its platform, you could say. It also came to accept it both on pragmatic grounds, primarily on pragmatic grounds. It worked, actually, to have the Americans carry the burden of Japanese defense, and also they didn't have the votes to actually enact a change.
Well, why is Japan having this debate now, 71, 72 years after the war, when it seems that Japan has been very successful as a nation with this structure in place?
Yes, and I think it's been a decade plus where this issue of revision has moved from a kind of back burner status in Japanese politics to the front burner, and now the burners seem to be on full blast. I think there are a number of factors. There's U.S. pressure on Japan to do more, not only in the narrow confines around Japan, but globally. There's a sense in Japan of new threats after the end of the Cold War, with the rise of China as a power and also the threatening presence or behavior of North Korea. So all of those things together, I think, have led to a shift in the leadership and to some extent in public opinion.
And given the size of its economy, Japan, I think, is the third largest economy in the world. It seems that it does punch below its weight in sort of international affairs in a lot of ways. Is this a way to sort of increase Japan's voice in the world?
Certainly. That's one of the logics, I think, behind the push to revise the Constitution.
And also on this point, too, is this move, is it in some ways sort of a reconciliation, or is it sort of a milestone in Japan's reconciliation with its World War II past, which obviously is still quite sensitive with many of its neighbors?
Yes, I think I wouldn't call it a reconciliation. It's a settlement that would satisfy a significant portion of Japanese public opinion that constitute the base of the LDP, the Liberal Democratic Party, and Prime Minister Abe. But it would be the reverse, I think, in terms of Japan's relations with its neighbors. And this is one concern that from the perspective of the Chinese, even the South Koreans, certainly North Koreans, this would be seen as an act that contravenes a position of Japan as a peaceful nation, even though these countries have militaries as well.
Well, Andrew Gordon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's effort to change Japan's pacifist constitution. Now, this move could allow the country to develop a military with offensive capabilities. We just spoke with Japanese historian Andrew Gordon of Harvard University. To broaden our discussion, we're going to bring in three people in Tokyo who are following this issue closely. Joining us is Isabel Reynolds. She's a Japan correspondent for Bloomberg News. Also with us is Kenneth McElwain, a professor of political science at the University of Tokyo. And also in Tokyo is Naoshige Mishishita. He's a professor at Japan's National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to all of you. Isabel Reynolds, let me start with you. President Abe's ruling Liberal Democrats just won this big victory in the recent elections, even though it seems like a lot of Japanese voters didn't really like him that much or like his policies. Tell us just a bit about that.
Yes, well, it's true. It was a pretty decisive victory, but there are a lot of reasons behind that. One of the main ones, I would say, is the division in the opposition. There wasn't one unified opposition party who could fight against the LDP in constituencies across the country. So that enabled the LDP to slip in a lot of constituencies where they might not otherwise have done. I think things like the security situation and the North Korean missiles, that certainly has helped Abe in recent months. And we can also point to the economy. The economy's been doing pretty well, particularly in the last couple of years. So a lot of people are happy on that front. So there have been a lot of factors that led to this. But it was an interesting campaign in that it's one of the first ones I've seen where the party has really put constitutional change right up front and center as something they want to have as part of their policy platform. So people voted for him, even though he had that. So it shows that the opposition perhaps to this potential change isn't as strong as it once used to be.
Well, Kenneth McElwain, back us up just a little bit. Tell us about what type of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has been. What are his politics?
I think Isabel is quite right on the nature of the election. For one, Prime Minister Abe has traditionally run and won on economic issues and promising to bolster Social Security. These are bread and butter issues that voters care about. But in this election, he did put constitutional revision explicitly on his agenda, in addition to dealing with the North Korean threat.
And by constitutional revision, specifically this pacifist clause.
Yes. Now, the Liberal Democratic Party has other items on its manifesto on what it wants to revise. But Article 9, I think, is very clearly the top priority for the Abe administration.
Well, Narushige Mishushita, talk to us a little bit about the debate about pacifism within Japanese politics. Is it sort of a partisan issue where some parties are for it, some parties against it? Does it look a little different than that?
Yeah, there is a debate between two groups of people. One group of people are isolationists, and the other group of people are internationalists. And the isolationists, they call themselves pacifists, and they basically say Japan must stay away from foreign wars and conflict, and the Constitution makes it easy for Japan to stay away. And thanks to the Constitution, we didn't have to send our troops, combat troops, to Afghanistan or Iraq. And so it's a great news, and so we have to maintain it. Internationalists, on the other hand, says that Japan must become a little bit more proactive in international security affairs. North Korea is developing nuclear weapons, missiles, capabilities. China is rising, then the United States is becoming a little more isolationist. So we have to do more in order to maintain balance of power, therefore peace and stability in this region.
And Isabel Reynolds, Abe's LDP and its coalition partner, they have, as I mentioned, 2/3 majorities in both houses of parliament. So it would seem like changing the constitution would be fairly straightforward, since that's sort of the magic number for changing the constitution there. But it sounds like people aren't saying this is going to happen overnight.
Right. Well, it's not as simple as it may look on the surface. I mean, that is a 2/3 majority. But look at who he's in coalition with. It's a Buddhist-backed party, which has a lot of pacifists, or as Michishita-san would call them, isolationists, among its supporters. So therefore, they are not necessarily on board with whatever change that Prime Minister Abe might want to make to Article 9. And in addition to that, even I think on the right wing, on the more, militaristic side of his support base, the suggestion he's making for how to change Article 9, I think is seen by some people as a little wishy-washy and a bit confusing. And they would like it to be a more straightforward change to say, yes, we can have a military, we're just like any other country. So he's going to have opposition on both sides to the idea that he's put forward so far.
So he's stopping short. What he's proposing is stopping short of what his critics would say makes Japan sort of a normal country, for lack of a better word.
Yes, I mean, what he's proposed earlier this year was to keep the Article 9 as it is and then add extra wording at the end to say, actually, but we are going to have a self-defense force. And a lot of people say, well, that's rather confusing. What does that actually mean? And also, if the vote were to go ahead, it has to go to a national referendum. And if the Japanese people were to reject that, one politician said to me, well, does that mean that we would then have to disband the SDF? Does that mean the Japanese people would have rejected the idea of having even self-defense forces?
Well, Kenneth McElwain, if you want to pick up on that point, as well as this idea that I understand there's maybe sort of a difference in how Japanese politicians view this issue and the Japanese public.
If you poll the public on whether or not they agree with simply listing the self-defense force in the Constitution, I think there's a bare majority that's in favor. But of course, if you write in a military, then all of a sudden you have to do a number of other things. First, you have to identify who the commander-in-chief is. That's not in the Constitution, because the current Constitution does not imagine an army. Then you have to consider things like, do we set up military tribunals that are separate from normal courts? And then you have to think about, well, what kind of bureaucracy or civil service is going to be in charge in maintaining civil-military relations? So as a general idea, I think people like accepting the self-defense force, which has wide support in the population. But once you start going down that path, there are a lot of other knock-on changes that sooner or later is going to run afoul of public opinion.
So it sounds like you have this strange situation, Kenneth, where the self-defense forces, the Constitution explicitly outlaws exactly what the self-defense forces are. And so there's sort of like this legal fiction around what they are and who is in control of them.
Mm-hmm. There are varying constitutional thoughts about this topic. I'd say the de facto or the most common understanding among constitutional scholars, at least, is yes, the Article 9 itself makes a self-defense force seem unconstitutional. On the other hand, a separate article, Article 13, ensures that the government has to protect people's individual liberties and happiness. And it's hard to defend people's individual happiness without a military. So the line in the sand, theoretically, is a self-defense force is good, but things like collective security, which is an issue that's been on the agenda in this election, does the Japanese self-defense force chip in to protect American forces, for example? That's where I think there's a lot of debate about the constitutionality of the status quo.
And Narushige Mishushita, if you could jump in, you've talked some about some sort of common myths about Japan's military role in the world. What are some of these myths about the self-defense forces and Japan's role in international security?
Yeah, before that, let me talk about the second clause of the Article 9. I don't actually like Mr. Abe's idea of adding the third clause to the current first and second clause, because the second clause says that Japan must not possess army, navy, and air force. And because of this clause, we have to keep lying about the nature of our armed forces. We say that these are not army, navy, and air force. These are ground self-defense force, maritime self-defense force, and air self-defense force, and they are not army, navy, and air force, but they are. And
In practice, if you look at the Japanese Navy and other navies of similar size, like, are there substantive differences in what their capabilities are?
No. Japan is the seventh largest spender on defense in the world, and Japanese armed forces are one of the best equipped, best trained armed forces in the world. So there are Army, Navy, and Air Force. So we have to change the constitution. This is my personal opinion. I know that to create a situation where we don't have to keep lying about the nature of the armed forces that we have.
You're tuned into Global Journalist. On today's show, we're talking about Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's effort to change the pacifist clause in Japan's post-World War II constitution. We're joined by Isabel Reynolds, a Japan correspondent for Bloomberg News, Kenneth McElwain, professor of political science at the University of Tokyo, and Naoshige Mishushita, a professor at Japan's National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies. If you want more Global Journalist, you can visit our website, globaljournalist.org. There you can find more coverage of underreported international news issues, including a new interview with an American cartoonist who has made a living for decades drawing Japanese political cartoons. You can also like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our videocast on YouTube, or get our podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Well, Isabel Reynolds, I want to turn this back to you because, as I had mentioned earlier, it does sound like there is a bit of a dichotomy between how Japan's politicians, its sort of political elite, views the importance of changing this pacifist clause in Japan's constitution and how ordinary people think about this.
Yes, well, I've seen at least two opinion polls about it since the election, so very recent ones, and one of them showed a plurality in favor of changing the constitution in line with Abe's ideas, and one of them showed a plurality against it. So I think we're very much on the cusp in that respect, which makes it a very risky issue for Abe. Now that we have a small but possibly growing opposition party that really wants to protect the current constitution, It could really turn into a political fight if he chooses to go into this. So that's why I'm not clear how serious he is about really digging into this issue now. Although he does have a solid majority now, in a year's time, he's got a leadership election for the party leadership position. So he does have other elections to worry about on the horizon. And then the year after that, there'll be an upper house election. So I think it remains to be seen whether he really is going to go ahead with this.
And literally, Isabel, with North Korea launching missiles seemingly every other week now, rapidly developing its nuclear capability, is this having a big impact on the Japanese public and how they view this?
Well, it's been a very interesting issue in that Abe has not really linked the two very clearly at all. When he first suggested these ideas, he was talking about issues like the reason why the SDF is, or one of the main reasons why the SDF is so popular in Japan, is because they take part in a lot of rescue missions. So if there's a national disaster, the SDF will be out there rescuing people, helping out, and they're seen as very sort of noble and heroic for good reason for that. So that's the kind of issue he was talking about. Here are these noble people, they're looking after us, And some of us are still saying that their existence is against the law, against the constitution. And he's saying that's not an acceptable situation. But he hasn't really linked the increasing security concerns in the region with this issue of the constitution.
Well, Kenneth McElwain, this seems quite strange, does it not? Like, North Korea is shooting missiles at Japan. The Prime Minister of Japan is saying we need to formalize our army, but he's not explicitly linking it to North Korea's nuclear capabilities or the fact that it is launching missiles directly over Japanese airspace.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what was seen at the status quo in the post-war period, and even in the first decade or so of the post-Cold War period, was North Korea that seemed containable. And perhaps still is containable, but now on the cusp, if not already possessing nuclear weapons, North Korea poses a very different kind of challenge. I'd say that in a foreign policy sense, Japan has always struggled with what's often been called a duality between abandonment and embrace. It doesn't want to be abandoned by the United States, and therefore it will chip in as necessary to keep the U.S. on its side. On the other hand, Japan also doesn't want to be dragged into conflicts that don't have much to do with Japan itself, the Middle East being such a case. And I think Abe has decided that he would rather push Japan more into the let's accept the risk of embrace in order to forego the possibility of abandonment.
Well, Narushige Mishushita, Kenneth McElwain did raise the issue of its relationship with the U.S., and President Trump is scheduled to visit Japan in early November. President Trump has made a number of different statements about the U.S. military commitment in East Asia. During the campaign, he called for Japan and South Korea to get their own nuclear weapons. He spoke of Japan exploiting the U.S. military umbrella in East Asia and competing unfairly, sort of exploiting the U.S. on trade. How do you see the relationship now, and how does this issue fit into it?
I think since he became the president, he has been briefed by a number of people about the situation in Asia on the Korean Peninsula. And one of his briefers, the most trusted one, has been actually Prime Minister Abe of Japan. And so when President Trump comes to visit Tokyo, he will be talking to Abe and again talk about how to deal with North Korea and China. And I think they are on good terms. And on these issues, actually, Mr. Trump is pretty well informed. So that's a good news.
Well, Isabel Reynolds, on this issue of Japan increasing its military capabilities, or at least formally sort of accepting itself as a military power, how is this issue viewed in China, which has historically seen Japan as a strategic rival, which much of China was occupied by Japan during the Second World War?
Yes, well, historically speaking, it's been seen very, very negatively in China. Whenever there's an anniversary of some horrendous event that occurred during the Second World War or before, China will take the opportunity to remind Japan of what went on. And urge them to remain on the path of peace. That's the kind of phrase that they often use. So I don't think it will go down very well. But on the other hand, I think it's obvious that the balance of power has changed completely between the two countries in the past 10 or 15 years. So I wonder how long China can really go on saying how terrified it is of Japan when China is now so much larger in terms of economy and probably in the future in terms of military power. So I don't know how long the world can continue to take seriously the kind of China quaking in its boots at the thought of Japan having a military.
Well, Kenneth McElwain, what about how is this issue viewed in South Korea and other parts of Asia, like Burma or the Philippines, that were occupied by the Japanese?
Well, I think there's no doubt that it's been obvious to Japan's neighbors for a while that if Japan wanted to build up a full-fledged military, so to speak, with offensive capabilities, it has the technical know-how to do so fairly rapidly. And Article 9 was seen as more of a commitment of intent. Now, revising Article 9, at least in the way that Prime Minister Abe is proposing, won't really change the nature of the self-defense force too much in a technological or offensive capacity sense, perhaps. But it does downgrade a sense that Japan's committed to the same type of pacifism it's had in the past. And that may certainly rattle some of Japan's neighbors.
And now, Ushigi Mishishita, I mean, if Japan has this robust military in all but name, why is it even important? Like, why bother with sort of changing the legal niceties around this?
That's a good point. I think amending the constitution is actually a symbolic issue rather than real policy issue. Because one of the most important foreign security commitment that Japan has made is to the defense of South Korea. And for that purpose, the Abe administration has revised the interpretation of the constitution without actually amending the constitution in 2015 and enacted a set of new security legislation, which made it possible for the self-defense force to operate closely with the U.S. forces if there is a war on the Korean Peninsula in support of the defense of South Korea. So as a policy, practical policy matter, we have increased our commitment to the defense of South Korea, and that's the most important, one of the most important objectives of the U.S.-Japan alliance. So there is not much policy needs anymore for amending the constitution.
And Isabel Reynolds, our time grows short. If you could just give me your brief forecast for how this issue will look 3 years from now, 4 years from now.
I think it very much depends on North Korea. If the threat from North Korea seems to be getting much worse, that could change public opinion in Japan quite rapidly. But of course, the Prime Minister would have to be prepared to link that more directly with his ideas for changing the constitution.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Andrew Gordon, Naoshige Mishishita, Isabel Reynolds, and Kenneth McElwain for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Ellen Beaton, Edom Kasaye, Courtney Manning, and Raina Sims, with supervising producer Lauren Wertman. Elisa Blyle is our visual editor, Aaron Hay is audio engineer, director is Travis McMillan. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.